Chapter 7. Tinsel stars hung from utility poles all up and down Sunset Boulevard, glittering in the sunshine, and plastic sleighs and reindeer stood on green lawns as if abandoned mid-route, Maynard imagined, during a sudden thaw. He moved his belongings into a corner unit on the top floor of the Havenhurst, a 1925 pastiche of architectural styles, its spiraled columns and ornate fleur-de-lis frieze seemingly tacked on as decorative afterthoughts to the otherwise solemn white stone building. His windows admitted a gentle cross breeze and the traffic sounds of Hollywood Boulevard, and outside his French doors, a small balcony overlooked the palms and red-tile roofs along Whitley Avenue. One long wall would be the perfect expanse to display his Kiss memorabilia, he determined, posters and photographs and ticket stubs he'd amassed over the years. He'd have plenty of time to arrange the collage later, but just now, he was eager to return the U-Haul and explore his new neighborhood. His first order of business was a visit to Tom and Jack's apartment, where he left a magnum of mum champagne at their door in thanks for their recent hospitality and to announce his arrival. "We were young, and it seemed both extravagant and a remarkably adult thing to do," Jack would later recall of his gift. "It was as though one of our peer group was acting like an actual grown-up." The afternoon was warm as June, the streets crowded with tourists and locals and abuzz with the energy Maynard had missed in Boston. He passed the Whiskey-A-Go-Go and the Palace and the Palladium, clubs shuttered and silent at midday, but topped with marquees promising light and sound and music come evening. Handbills littered the sidewalks, colorful flyers printed to their edges with drawings and grainy photographs and announcements of the punk and metal and grunge, of the Dickies and Helmet and L7. He stopped to read message boards layered with leaflets 3 and 4 deep, outdated notices of appearances by Jane's Addiction and Soundgarden and the Pixies, stapled over with news of upcoming concerts, Celebrity Skin, Hole, and the Imperial Butt Wizards, whose act, he would learn, often included setting fire to the stage. Los Angeles waitresses weren't really waitresses, he discovered. Short-order cooks and bank tellers fancied themselves front men of the next hair metal band, and tour bus drivers had higher aspirations than forever transporting gawkers to stars' homes in the Hollywood Hills. They scheduled their day jobs around rehearsals and casting calls, gigs and costume fittings, and rushed to lessons in guitar and voice and the method in their relentless determination to become the best in a city of bests. Maynard approached his duties at the pet store with the same commitment, the unquestioning work ethic he'd learned by necessity in Scottville. In Michigan, you don't shovel snow to build your biceps. You shovel snow because you need to get the car out to go to work, he would explain. You lift weights and work out because you want to win the wrestling match and the track meet. Working hard in order to reach a goal, to finish the job, always felt to me like a natural, human instinct thing to do. Finishing his Petland project would entail 3 or 4 days at each of the chain's stores throughout the region, his supervisor told him, dismantling shelves and end caps and reconfiguring aisles. But if it were to be done properly, his assignment would take longer than that. Stock boys and cashiers must be trained to take advantage of the new layout, and it fell to Maynard to teach them the secrets of the upsell, the chew-bone pickup he'd so successfully instituted at Boston Pet. The little black skipperkey cocked his head, his dark eyes following Maynard's every move as he rolled a pallet of dog chow toward the back of the store. Maynard paused before the puppy's illuminated cubicle. It would take time, he knew, to establish a faux family like the one he'd formed in Boston, and in the meantime, the devoted and curious Zippy would be companion enough. And with so much to discover in the city of excess and possibility, loneliness was the furthest thing from Maynard's mind. His holiday gift to himself was a choice seat at Devo's Christmas Day show at a club just up the street. And a week later, he took the short flight up the coast to attend the B-52's concert at San Francisco's Civic Auditorium. The next night, accompanied by longtime friend Kathy Larson, he rang in 1990 at the Psychedelic Furs Berkeley stop on their East of Eden tour. It didn't, after all, take him long to find his social niche. By virtue of his relationship with Gloria, the Libertyville transplants, his hosts Tom Morello and Jack Olson and their classmates who'd followed their passions to L.A., accepted Maynard as one of their own. Theirs was an instant friendship that nearly didn't happen at all.
Gloria had called him explaining that I was coming to town for a job interview and needed a place to stay. Tom checked the machine and wrote down her message for Jack to find. On it he wrote, "Tell her no." But Jack never saw the note.
When Maynard showed up at her door, Jack would recall, Tom and I looked at each other like, who is this guy? The close-knit community provided a sort of psychological ballast as its members struggled to gain a toehold in the entertainment world. Their relaxed gatherings helped ease doubts about their careers, whether Jack's entry-level position as a script reader was the first step toward his becoming a writer, what new music venture Tom would embark upon after the imminent dissolve of Lockup, whether Adam Jones's studies at the Hollywood Makeup Academy would bring success. The group was a good grounding element amid the insecurity of trying to make our way in our creative endeavors, Tom would remember. It was good to maintain all these friends from the old country, much like immigrants would do when they came to America. We were really charmed by Maynard. He came across as a good Midwestern dude, and he was a welcome addition. Like Maynard, the Libertyville expatriates were bright and talented, had excelled in high school dramatics, and found inspiration in heavy metal, and their Midwestern warmth and sense of humor equaled his own. On Saturday afternoons, Maynard joined them in touch football games in the park, and despite his lackluster skills, he became a member of their midnight bowling team.
When you first get to L.A., it's very romantic, but it's huge. It seemed like everybody had some connection with somebody else, and everyone was one-upping each other with cool stuff that's going on. The Libertyville crew took the sting out of the move. So many people were trying to suck your blood in that town, and here was a place with no agendas. I didn't give a fuck about how well they could play guitar, and nobody cared about Jack's chiseled chin. We were just bowling.
Before long, Maynard was a fixture at the weekend barbecues, cookouts attended by as many as 25 Libertyville alumni. They brought potato salad and six-packs to Tom and Jack's pool, or Adam's loft, where they reported on the week's auditions and job offers and reminisced about high school escapades and Electric Sheep, the garage band Tom and Adam had formed when they were sophomores. And they introduced Maynard to the Libertyville song written by Tom and Electric Sheep vocalists Chris George and Adam, a silly campfire song they called Country Boner. They were as impressed with Maynard's accomplishments as he with theirs, eagerly viewing the Polaroids he shared around the picnic table of his arrangements of Habit Trails. He was the most successful person we knew, Tom would recall. He had a career and a company car, and he was very proud of his work. Here was a guy who could walk into a pet land and decide where everything should be put, Jack would echo. As quirky as that sounds in retrospect, at the time it seemed like a genuine, actual job to us. Committed to one day finding his true place in contemporary rock, Tom kept his finger on the pulse of the L.A. music scene, learning all he could of cutting-edge sounds and industry trends. "I went to shows 6 or 7 nights a week," he explained. "In those days, you went to your friends' shows. You went to shows of people you didn't know. I just lived rock." Maynard was a more than willing companion in Tom's darting from club to club, elated to explore with him the many and varied venues scattered about the city. Club with No Name, English Acid, Raji's beneath the old Hastings Hotel, and the Coconut Teaser, with its sawdust-covered floors and complimentary barbecued hot dogs on Sundays. Established musicians mingled during set breaks with unknown hopefuls, with A&R reps and ardent groupies alike, in a convivial and spirited atmosphere that encouraged a healthy competition among performers. "We met Gene Simmons at Club Lingerie one night," Tom would recall. He would often come to club shows, and Maynard told him excitedly, like a fan, about his hallway covered with Kiss collectibles. "That was the beginning of my living high on the hog, for a minute," Maynard would remember. Perseverance and unexpected turnings had brought him inexorably to this, enviable and satisfying work, a sudden circle of supportive friends, the diner near Tom and Jack's apartment that welcomed him among its breakfast regulars, and blocks from his door, a vibrant music milieu where chance encounters with longtime idols were a matter of course. At night, he stepped from his French doors to his balcony. Zippy lifted his nose to the warm breeze, and Maynard sipped his tea, looking down across the white city, where lights extended bright beyond Wilshire Boulevard, all the way to Culver City. Despite Maynard's track record in Boston, the higher-ups at Petland couldn't quite see the value of his strategies, much less understand how to implement them. As far as they could tell, he did little more than move products from one aisle to the other, relatively pointless work, they thought, that didn't justify his top-dollar salary. 2 weeks before his probationary period was to end, they took back the keys to the company truck in exchange for his final paycheck. "Everybody has moments of doubts when they think, 'What the hell's going to happen next?'" Maynard would explain. "And then you find out." With 6 months remaining on his lease and no job prospects in sight, he panicked. His career path hadn't been exactly focused, and without a college degree, his chances of receiving another offer seemed unlikely. Early every morning, he and Zippy walked to the bus stop on the corner and rode the 5 miles to Adam's apartment in the valley. The big backyard would give the energetic puppy plenty of room to play and explore, while Maynard crisscrossed the city in search of work, his pockets stuffed with bus tokens and a map of the metro system. Out sunset, along Santa Monica Boulevard, as far as Culver City, he pressed buzzers and knocked on doors and followed the blind alleys listed in the classified section of the Times. And after a particularly discouraging day of interviews, he returned one evening to discover a freshly dug tunnel below Adam's fence, and Zippy gone.
I walked up the street trying to figure out where Zippy might have run. I asked some people if they'd seen a dog, and they said, yeah, he went that way. I went in the direction until I saw a couple guys doing construction, and I asked them, have you seen a little black dog? Then the cops pulled up. I went straight to Officer Butts and said to her, I'm looking for a small. And she just said, hands on the car. What? I'm looking for a small? Yeah, sure you are. No, just ask those people. My dog got out of the backyard right over here on Willowcrest. Yeah, you're looking for drugs. I'm not looking for drugs. I'm looking for my dog. It turns out I had a parking ticket I didn't know about on that pet store truck, and they arrested me and took me to the station. They handcuffed me to a bench and took me to a cell and locked me up overnight because of the bullshit warrant I didn't know I had. Adam and his buddy Sean came down and bailed me out. They waited for hours, and at 3 a.m. they asked, so, could we have our friend? And another guy comes out of the back and goes, oh yeah, your friend was processed out like 3 hours ago. Now I've got to pay Adam back for bail. I don't have any money. And if I'd had a chance of finding Zippy, it was gone now.
The path that had been so clear after he'd read Little Big seemed now impassable, shadowed and forked in nothing but dead ends. John Crowley's book had resonated with his deepest belief, his certainty that taking one step after the next could propel him toward his deepest desires. But as with any mountaintop experience, the elation faded in the face of the demands and disappointments of everyday life. Had Maynard read Little Big with a more analytical eye, he would have noticed in the final chapter Crowley's hint of that inevitable sense of loss. One of the central feelings of sophisticated modern people is that they somehow missed out on participating in a magical world, Crowley explained in a 2014 interview. We only find traces of it in songs and stories and poetry, but we're always disappointed because we're not really in it. And experiencing that magic through movies and books is worse than never having it, because we get exiled when the book's over. There's an acknowledgement of that at the end of Little Big, And if the book affected Maynard that much, he's got to have felt that same sadness of exile from the magic. Maynard's feelings were more profound even than that. "I was freaking the fuck out," he would remember. "I lost my dog, lost my apartment, lost my job, lost my car, all within the space of 3 months. I went from having a little extra money to play with to nothing." Maynard had reached an ending, yes, but one he had the power, in fact, the duty, he realized, to alter. He could return to Boston, yes, would be welcomed back at Boston Pet with open arms. "I was not happy at all when he moved to California," Deborah Alton would explain. "That was the end of the overnight crew and the beautiful merchandising." But it wasn't time to turn back yet. As long ago as junior year in high school, Maynard had vowed to take advantage of every opportunity to write and draw and sing, and surely his passion for art and understanding of its practical application were all the magic he needed. Hollywood's production companies depended on the out-of-work actors, the between-gigs musicians, and the LA newcomers to perform the minimum-wage grunt work that brought their films and commercials to Technicolor life. Artistic vision was necessary to succeed even as an art dog temp, the ability to craft scenery and props on the fly, to assist the art department with set dressing for Boys to Men videos and movie trailers. And God help me, Maynard would recall, a Cinderella video. He quickly learned the tricks of his new trade, tricks not so different from foraging scrap lumber from Mike's workshop to construct a stand for his stereo. Resourceful, as always, he fabricated illusion from the most mundane of materials. Nailed just so to the studio floor, he discovered, inexpensive paneling from the discount aisle at Home Depot would easily pass for costly oak under the flashing strobes of a dance video. A shoot might last from dawn to dusk, 16 hours or more, a job interrupted time and again when the director realized a part of the set must be rebuilt or a prop hadn't yet been acquired. It was Maynard's job to create glamour and opulence from wood and brads and tape and back-breaking manual labor.
On one project, they needed riding crops for an R&B video. The scene was an alley, wet like after a rain, with steam coming out of the manhole covers. The dancers were supposed to do a Michael Jackson-type routine, all of them dressed in black leather and carrying riding crops, but somebody forgotten to get the riding crops. It would take too long to go out and find real ones, and time is money. So I just jumped in the dumpster, found some long, semi-flexible things, and wrapped them in black gaffer tape. With all the action and the lights, no one would figure out what they really were.
The unpredictable schedule might mean 2 long days of work, 4 at the most, followed by a week of waiting for the phone to ring. And when the call finally came, Maynard rose early and wasted a precious hour in a circuitous bus route to the studios. Before long, the commute became tedious and costly given his meager pay. Sharing Adam's apartment would do until he was back on his feet, and sleeping on his floor wouldn't be so bad if it meant an extra few minutes in his bedroll in the morning before walking down the block to catch his ride with a fellow set designer. By now, Adam had found work creating special effects for films, and his companionship was a welcome break from the grueling hours in the studio. Maynard looked forward to hearing of his plans for his fledgling band Mother, and of the stop-motion film techniques he was learning. And, fascinated, Adam listened to the cassettes Maynard popped into the player, bands he'd never before heard of, Texans and CAD, and their driving lyrics about stalking butlers and paths of must we. And in the mornings, Maynard checked behind the cushions of Adam's chairs for the nickels and dimes that must stretch until payday, and left at sunrise for the studio. "It was a bitter time," he would recall. "I'm working 15-hour days, but I'm still fucking broke. The money isn't steady, and it isn't much, maybe $100 for 24 hours. It's long days, but at least I know I'm going to have food on the table." In the short time Maynard had lived in L.A., the city's music scene had undergone a sea change. Leaflets no longer cluttered Sunset Boulevard, and the tattered flyers still posted outside the clubs announced performances long past. The Seattle grunge scene had spawned by the late 80s scores of garage bands across the country, underground and heavy metal and alternative groups that, with a little help from friends willing to share studio space, formed on a shoestring a cottage industry of independent recording companies. Every week had seen the release of countless indie albums and EPs, vinyl and cassettes that overflowed the bins at Music Plus and Tower Records, a smorgasbord of experimental sounds and lyrics and subgenres to satisfy the most discriminating of audiences. It didn't take long for established recording companies like A&M and Geffen to recognize the gold mine just within their reach. They had the resources and infrastructure to promote and market the handful of albums sure to be million sellers, and the deep pockets to pay for ads and performance space and radio play. They engaged in frantic bidding wars to sign the most promising bands, the handful of rap and alt and rock groups guaranteed to outsell all the rest. And by mid-1990, the customer-driven music model had been turned on its head. The record-buying public had been as autonomous as the bands, but the new model directed their tastes and their wallets toward the industry favorites. The indies found themselves head-to-head with the likes of Soundgarden and Alice in Chains and Nirvana, and without the means to compete, receded further into obscurity. Only a few clubs were willing to even book underpromoted acts, acts that might never come close to filling the house. The Whiskey A Go-Go remained, and the Rainbow, the Gaslight, and Al's Bar, and the Central, where unknown bands were still welcomed and assured of a first-time public performance. On many nights, Maynard and Tom could be found at one or another, in support of Mother, of Tom's musician friends, of the bands that refused to play the corporate game. They made their way from Club With No Name to Raji's, up the moonlit blocks to the pub hosting Green Jello, the quirky spoof rock band formed in Buffalo some years before. Leather-jacketed friends might go their separate ways halfway through the night and reassemble later at another club across town, their entourage growing larger and louder at every stop. Adam and Sean, Joe and Kurt and Kira, and Caroline, who knew the Green Jello members well. And Maynard, who sat in the shadows sipping his White Russian, observing the shifting scene, and wondering all the while where he might fit in. The squat white building on Hollywood Boulevard was renowned for having been, during the film industry's earliest days, the Cecil B. DeMille production studio, and now continued the tradition of creative innovation as home base of Green Jello. The group's founder, Bill Manspeaker, lived there, Caroline explained when she introduced the band members to Maynard, and drummer Danny Carey had a loft nearby. The neighborhood sounded to Maynard like a microcosm of Hollywood itself, a vibrant place, energetic and devoted to unbridled creativity. And although this space was already home to Manspeaker, his wife, and old friends from Buffalo, a vacant room could certainly be Maynard's if he'd like to move in. The building's topmost floor was taken up by the enormous open loft with small bedrooms partitioned around its periphery. DeMille's projection booth had been converted to a kitchen, and a window still opened onto the living area where his crew had gathered to view dailies of the Ten Commandments or Cleopatra after a day's filming. One more roommate would hardly disrupt life at the loft. The space was stacked with couch cushions, salvaged on trash night from Hollywood sidewalks, foam squares and rectangles that would see new life once Bill fashioned them into the heads and bodysuits of the Green Jello characters, Cow God and Rock and Roll Pumpkin and Shit Man. Deep into the night, the loft jangled with the sounds of arcade games, buzzers and bells and metallic beeps of Space Invaders and Operation Wolf. A counterpoint to the ministry Bill blasted as he bent over his work table, assembling the band's outlandish costumes. On weekends, the loft became party central. Friends and friends of friends came and went, sometimes until 4 in the morning, to mosh with the latest LA bands who performed at one end of the room, much to the chagrin of the neighbors on the other side of the common wall. "I built the loft so that people could come here and do whatever they wanted," Manspeaker explained in a 2014 interview. "And here was Maynard. He was kind of quiet and shy and grumpy. I believe that loft was a door for him. All of a sudden, he was in this place where it was okay to be weird. If he sometimes needed a break from the pandemonium, Maynard walked across the lot to Danny's building, the old DeMille livestock barn, where, under the carpeting, traces of feed troughs could still be seen in the concrete floor. Danny had fashioned from the space a compact apartment and adjoining rehearsal room where Green Jello explored their routines. On the nights he didn't perform with Carol King or Wild Blue Yonder or Pygmy Love Circus, he set up his drum kit and worked on new numbers with the band. And Maynard listened, delighting in the characters and costumes, the music, the masks. Even amid the chaos and commotion of the loft, Maynard managed to recreate his oasis, a retreat amid the comings and goings of Bill's heaps of papier-mâché, glue pots, and bolts of fabric. Against one wall of his room, he built a sleeping platform high above the floor to make space for potted plants hung with tiny nests for Harpo and the other finches, for aquariums stocked with geckos and chameleons, for an elaborate ecosystem of waterfalls and ferns and luminous goldfish. Across a 4x8 length of plywood, he constructed embankments and valleys molded with quickrete over a chicken wire frame and painted in soft greens and browns. Water spilled from the reservoir atop the highest hill, down into the fish pond, and through a system of pumps and hoses, circulated again up the hill, gurgling gently. Late at night, the sounds of arcade games faint behind his door. Maynard gazed down from his bunk at the dozing animals, the tiny gray birds settling into their nests, the fish gliding slowly among the aquatic plants. Lulled by the bubbling waterfall and the soft chirping of his menagerie, he drifted toward sleep, imagining sand dunes and stars, snow across some faraway bridge, stories shared around a campfire. On Friday and Saturday nights, the streets below Maynard's windows echoed with shouts and raucous laughter, car horns, and the pointless revving of souped-up engines. Those were the nights suburban youths descended upon the city to cruise the boulevards to see and be seen. Along Hollywood and Sunset, traffic was at a dead stop in a gridlock that stretched from Western all the way to La Brea, car stereos blaring a cacophonous medley of the Pogues and Motorhead and the Alarm.
On more than one occasion, I stood on the roof and watched women go from one car to another and rabbit punch each other in the face. I guess these girls recognized rivals in the car behind them, or some chick who'd looked at their boyfriend wrong, who knows. The girls would get out of one car and swoop in another car. They'd open the doors and grab a handful of hair and start punching the shit out of the girl. Watching this, I started wondering how extensive my atrium had to be and how thick I needed to build my walls.
The stream of customers at the discount Regal Liquors next door only added to the mayhem and tense atmosphere. Vagrants and derelicts stumbled all night long into the shop to trade their begged, borrowed, and stolen change for off-brand strawberry schnapps and nickel nips, then claimed the nearby stoops and alleys as their weekend turf. "Our neighborhood was a war zone," Danny would recall. "We had to fend off bums and cretins and criminals and all these people that came back into the parking lot and slept on our doorsteps, urinating and defecating everywhere. But there was strength in our numbers." Maynard's street smarts, honed in the anti-punk neighborhoods of Grand Rapids, served him well. "He had good survival skills and knew how to get rid of these people," Danny said. "We bonded over that from the beginning and made the best of an ugly situation." When Maynard noticed particularly disruptive activity in the lot, he shouted from his bedroom window to Danny, and the two met outside, baseball bats in hand. "We'd make them pick up their duty so I didn't have to do it," Danny explained. "It was just painful." Maynard had known when he'd come to L.A. that his choice would bring both benefits and consequences, But the swaying palms and balmy afternoons, and even living in the center of a vibrant music scene, couldn't offset his despair. What had been promised had turned to its shadow side, a no-man's land of insecurity and wariness. His set work was satisfying enough. His last-minute cleverness when the art department panicked over missing props. When halfway through the shooting of Tom Petty's Into the Great Wide Open video, they found they were short a microphone, it was Maynard to the rescue. Running down to SIR to buy or rent one would cost them 2 hours, he would explain. I told them to hold on. I could take care of it. A length of duct tape and an empty toilet paper roll was all it took to fashion the realistic-looking mic Johnny Depp held in his nightclub scene. But quick thinking and ingenuity didn't pay the bills, nor did the quarters and dimes he found scattered on the sidewalk outside Regal's on Sunday mornings. He'd seen the flyers posted throughout the city calling for background extras in films and television shows, and now he began to read them more closely. Non-speaking actors could earn $50 a day, he learned, and if their appearance was especially unique, they could command even more. Perhaps his long, wavy hair, wiry frame, and studded leather were unusual enough to land him a role or two. Jack Olson, he realized, might serve as a mentor of sorts, a film industry professional with insider insights, and Maynard arranged a lunch meeting to discuss his possible entry into show business. Here was a guy thinking about working as an extra, talking to a guy who read screenplays, Jack would recall. We couldn't have been anywhere closer to the absolute bottom of the entertainment pyramid, but we proceeded with great seriousness. Maynard always had a kind of adult focus. Working as an extra, Jack told him, sounded even more unreliable than temping as a set decorator. But Maynard was determined to piece together whatever odd jobs he could to make ends meet, and he spent his evenings calling the numbers printed on the strips he'd torn from the flyers. He left countless voice messages that disappeared into the AT&T ether. Once in a great while, he reached a recruiter, only to learn the roles had been cast days before. By spring, he'd appeared in only 2 or 3 crowd scenes in unremarkable films, films forgotten almost before their release, his roles undistinguished and uncredited. Clearly, finding film work would require more than a studded jacket and tight black jeans. Maynard had put plans in place before, seen them through step by step to completion, and surely he could do it again. Here I was in Hollywood, so I thought I might as well take advantage of classes and workshops and learn to do shit, he recalled. As soon as my paycheck was spent, I could barely feed the animals, but I mapped it all out. If I could work X number of set gigs, I could pay my rent, buy food, and take some acting classes. By night, Hollywood Boulevard's 6100 block was dominated by Raji's, the smoky, jam-packed club where strung-out junkies consorted with the queens just back from nearby drag bars. Concert-goers clustered in the shadows behind the club, passing joints and convincing the sympathetic bouncers to allow them back inside for the closing set of The Nymphs or Thelonious Monster. But by day, the block was serene, the destination of committed actors and ingenues who dreamed of joining Brando and De Niro and Candice Bergen as alumni of the Stella Adler Academy. One of the many such schools throughout the city, the Academy catered to the steady influx of hopefuls whose boundless faith in the courses and workshops kept their dreams of stardom alive. Maynard walked the 3 blocks from the loft to his classes in scene preparation and character analysis, voice and movement, and visualization techniques he'd need to bring convincing realism to his roles. No matter what your scene is, he explained, it has to be about your mother being run over by a truck. You make it real by making an emotional investment, by going to the memory of something that puts that look behind your eyes. Until the day his acting training would pay off, Maynard rationed his animal's food, replenishing it when his next paycheck arrived, and in the meantime, closely monitoring what remained. One day, Danny recalled, he ran low on crickets, so I gave him a ride to the closest pet store to get buckets full of them to release into his bedroom. As soon as he jumped in my beat-up BMW, he expressed his interest in getting a band together. Stunned, Danny glanced across the console toward Maynard, the set decorator with the curious menagerie, the neighborhood defender adept at wielding a baseball bat. Danny had passed many a free evening in the green jello loft, challenging Bill to a round of Space Invaders, and sharing stories with Maynard of their high school accomplishments on the wrestling mat and track practice along muddy Midwest roadsides. Maynard had told him of West Point Prep and the frame shop in Boston, but until then had never hinted of musical talents or an interest in performing. "Then he popped a tape in the cassette deck and played me some of his favorite songs," Danny continued. "Industrial 80s things, and Nirvana, which nobody really knew about yet. And I was like, well, this sounds kind of cool." Intrigued as he was with the songs on Maynard's mixtape, Danny ignored his hint of a musical collaboration. Between Green Jello and his other gigs, he had no time or intention to even consider becoming involved with another band. But Maynard was restless. Participation, he knew, could be a partial remedy for his financial and employment anxieties. A headlong plunge into the punk club world would be at least a distraction, at most a step toward regaining a modicum of self-confidence. "He was the weenie guy," Jack would recall. "We used to joke that his part-time job was as a performer, throwing hot dogs to the crowd." Maynard had become by now an established member of the movable L.A. music feast, mingling from club to club with friends of friends and audiences often made up only of members of the next band on the bill, Green Jello, or Lock Up, or Electric Love Hogs, or the ubiquitous angry bands competing to become the next Red Hot Chili Peppers. "They were funky metal, bonky bonky snap snap guys," Maynard explained. Before long, Love Hogs fans looked forward to Maynard's antics as eagerly as they did the band itself. He toted a 12-pack of hot dogs to English Acid, the underground club on West Pico, and slipped over his head a white apron, "Satan's Weenies," printed across the bib. In the shadows at stage left, a toque atop his head, he warmed the hot dogs in a microwave, then meticulously slathered them with ketchup and mustard, and wrapped them, somewhat securely, in baggies. Guitars blazing and drumsticks a blur, the Love Hogs snarled their lyrics, tossed their heads, and leapt across the stage, while Maynard, with a leaf blower from the nearby Home Depot, propelled the hot dogs into the delighted crowd. His role, albeit peripheral, was like a tonic, as intoxicating as the long-ago days of lip-syncing to the Jacksons in his Ohio basement. Forming a band of his own seemed increasingly far-fetched in a city where new talent emerged overnight and disappeared just as quickly. Suggesting he join Adam's band was out of the question. Mother's vocalist and musician lineup was complete. But if Maynard wished to test his music mettle, he realized, the opportunity was at his fingertips. Green Jello looked like a perfect fit, he remembered. Bill had an open-door policy, meaning I could come and go as I pleased. I was like, okay, if I want to get involved in any of this, this might be the way. Green Jello's rotating cast of characters was an ever-changing array of costume and mask, a group whose job it was to provoke, to amuse, to tell stories. As part of the troupe of shifting personas, Maynard could explore just what his place in the entertainment world might be, and develop a stage presence as he portrayed rock idols and nursery story characters and a mustachioed, white-haired redneck he called Billy Bob. Manspeaker had, from its inception, dubbed Green Jello the world's worst band, the band with the sole purpose of being mocked. Whoever was in the band was encouraged to do that thing the teacher told them was dumb or their mom told them they couldn't do, he explained. Serious vocalists and musicians joined the troupe for the chance to let their hair down, to forget for a little while the constraints of their profession, to experiment and explore and make all the mistakes they wanted. "You don't have to fear being bad because you're already saying you're bad," Manspeaker said of its members. "You're the best at being the worst. That's what Green Jello's about." April 13, 1991, marked the most well-attended Green Jell-O show to date. It seemed like there were 1,000 people there, Danny remembered. That was a really fun show. The punk energy was definitely in the air. The evening in the Hollywood High gymnasium was as eclectic as it was electrifying. A more conventional dance band would perform for the school's junior prom in only a few weeks, but the April show was the antithesis of pastel gowns and wrist corsages. Punks and moshers crowded the gym floor, their cheers and screams reverberating from the high ceilings when the opening act, the punk rock Dickies, made their entrance. A power outage interrupted their performance, and the audience began filing disappointed from the auditorium. But the lights came back up just in time for the somewhat incongruous second act, Tiny Tim, who strummed his ukulele and grinned through his signature Tiptoe Through the Tulips and America. Next on the bill was headliner Celebrity Skin, the secondhand store version of glam rock. A maniacal, revolving jack-in-the-box clown announced their arrival in keeping with their theme of the evening, Under the Big Top. And then it was Green Jell-O's turn. Guitarists and vocalists filled the stage, their costumes and masks crowding the small space. The long latex spider legs, attached to Danny Longlegs's back, bounced with his every beat, his cymbals glinting under the spotlight. As MC, Maynard announced the performers as they morphed from character to character in a variety show treatment they called A History of Rock and Roll According to Green Jell-O. The premise was this bad version of the history of rock and roll, Manspeaker would explain. We started from the beginning of time and went through the present day, and when we got to the future, the idea was that all the 90s would have to offer would be Green Jell-O, and they suck. Their chronicle began with Maynard's flawless and urgent embodiment of Ted Nugent, his strong, sure voice rising in The Great White Buffalo. In loincloth and wig, he told the lyrical tale of mythologies and magic, of Indian lore and the white man's destruction, of ultimate salvation. He transitioned from Nugent to Johnny Rotten, delivering a driving rendition of Anarchy in the UK that brought the audience to its feet. Verse after verse, his intensity increased, his growl deepened. Just as they'd instructed in the Stella Adler workshops, he remembered, and remembered again. Endless Boston winters, a rainy Grand Rapids street, a lead pipe tucked in his sleeve. Coins collected from a gritty sidewalk. Red lights like a strobe against a split-rail fence. The Sex Pistols' lyrics became his own. His scream of anger, his bitter resolve to at last have what he wanted, his long-repressed wish to destroy. "Here's Maynard," Manspeaker would recall, "this shy, quiet dude who's kind of grumpy sometimes. Then you give him a microphone and he turns into fucking Johnny Rotten." His song segued into Green Jell-O's adaptation, Anarchy in Bedrock, and the cast joined his lyrical desire not to annihilate but to become Fred Flintstone, their shrill yabba-dabba-doos echoing through the gym, Bill and Gary Helsinger, skinhead versions of Fred and Barney Rubble, chased each other up and down the aisles, shattering the fourth wall and drawing the eager audience into the performance. If the future of rock and roll was to be Green Jell-O and Green Jell-O only, the Hollywood High crowd wasn't one to argue. The penultimate piece, Obey the Cow God, was a crowd-pleasing extravaganza featuring Manspeaker in an oversized bovine head, his red eyes flashing as he strutted across the stage, demanding submission. When the lights came up on Green Jell-O's closing number, the audience stood and shouted as one. The stage was set for the band's newest piece, Three Little Pigs, complete with miniature houses of straw and wood and brick. Moshing pigs accompanied the bullying wolf in updated lyrics to the old tale, their long latex tongues lolling from massive latex heads. In a frenzied finale, the stage erupted in clashing cymbals and droning guitars and faux machine gun fire trained on Manspeaker's Big Bad Wolf, as he burst among the pigs in defiance of Maynard's falsetto, "Not by the hair of my chinny chin chin." Becoming an onstage little pig, or bewigged Ted Nugent, satisfied Maynard's dramatic urges and provided a pleasant diversion from his long days building sets. His involvement with Manspeaker's band gave him entree into the wider music world of rehearsals and creative comrades, and the chance to observe bands that shared the bill with Green Jello at venues throughout L.A. After the clubs closed at night, Tom Morello often accompanied him back to the loft, where they discussed Devo's innovative time signatures and the blues roots of Led Zeppelin. They loaded the tape deck with music a step beyond the mainstream, the obscure and innovative music Maynard had always appreciated the most. "I remember he played for me a Swans album, which was way outside my comfort zone," Tom would recall. Maynard explained the group's minimalist chord structures, the emotional effect of their snarling vocals, their primal interpretation of heavy metal, and Tom took careful note. Now that Lockup had officially dissolved, Tom focused his energies on laying the groundwork for a new band he planned to call Rage Against the Machine, a group he envisioned would push the boundaries of metal and challenge political complacency. Determined that Rage would be a cut above the fledgling bands he and Maynard saw at Coconut Teaser and Raji's, he set about learning all he could to avoid the missteps that had doomed Lockup. "Maynard taught me drop-D tuning," Morello would recall. The two sat on the park bench that completed the aviary's decor. Maynard created Tom's Fender Telecaster and tuned the low E string to D to create the Seattle sound, the heavy resonance that gave bands like Soundgarden and Nirvana and Pearl Jam their signature sonic quality. Tom had recruited the best of the best to populate his new band. Longtime musician Tim Comerford on bass and backup vocals, and Greta drummer Brad Wilk, who'd contribute his extensive percussion skills. He had only to identify a suitable lead vocalist to round out his ensemble. By now, he'd attended plenty of Maynard's Green Jello performances, had heard the CAD cassettes, and respected Maynard's vocal talents as highly as his ability to analyze complex arrangements. "There was sort of in the air an idea of us working together," Tom would recall. "Brad and I had been jamming with both Maynard and Zach De La Rocha. We really liked playing with both of them, and Brad and I had this long phone call to discuss who we should ask to the dance." In the end, rapper De La Rocha proved to be the most logical partner. His hardcore band, Inside Out, had gained a substantial underground following, and his success would help validate Rage. It would be only a matter of time, Tom told himself, before his band would be noticed by one of the labels scrambling to be the first to sign distinctive and serious acts. Even Bill Manspeaker, whose group included clownish farm animals and a moped zipping across the stage, and little apparent talent save Danny's drumming, came home one evening and announced Green Jello's 11-song video deal with BMG affiliate Zoo Entertainment. "When I saw them perform, they got up there with stuff they'd collected from the garbage, the foam they made these costumes out of," Zoo founder Lou Malia recalled in a 2014 interview. "I thought, yeah, they suck, but they've got something going." Maynard's minimal Green Jello role hardly warranted a recording contract, and he'd written nothing new since his Grand Rapids days. No guitarists or drummers were on deck to perform even his CAD songs, and he'd prepared no business plan or artistic manifesto. But he had one thing most other bands lacked. From his table in the shadows at the back of Club With No Name or English Acid, he cast a jaundiced eye on the performers who cavorted about the stage. "I'm at the back of the room watching those bands and criticizing everything they did," he would remember. "They clearly wanted to be up there, but they didn't have a need to be up there."
These bands were just there to dance around and be popular and get into the club without paying or to get laid, to catch the attention of an A&R guy who might be in the audience or whatever it was they were trying to do. They're wearing stupid hats and hopping around and not telling any story at all. And they're not even bonky bonky snapping very well. The whole scene was just vapid.
If he were ever to take his place in the spotlight, Maynard knew, his act would involve more than superficial leaping about. He had stories to tell, decades of stories, and an aching need to tell them. His was an instinctive drive to transform pain and loneliness to riffs and chords, an imperative to translate fear and disappointment and plans gone awry to words and rhyme, until sadness and anger dissipated in pulsating sound that beat in rhythm with his soul. Even if you don't know what your endgame is or what you're trying to do, if you fucking mean it, I can feel it, Maynard explained. When Brando did a scene, he meant it. When Didi Ramon hit the stage, he meant it, even if it was the 1,000,000th time he'd done it. I wasn't seeing that in L.A. Maynard's frustration only grew when he realized he'd become an appalling cliché. Just one more jaded L.A. hipster living hand-to-mouth and finding fault with the soulless posturing of bands whose sense of teamwork was as out of tune as their thrift shop guitars. Eventually, people got tired of overhearing me being a judgmental asshole, he would recall. They finally started saying, well, if you think you can do better, why don't you?